You want the microphone? That'll be $3. I only got 87 cents, right? I got to contribute to the American economy.
So first of all, hi everybody. I'm. Can you hear me okay?
No.
No. How's that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not too loud.
So for those I haven't met, my name is Beatty. I'm an SE with Juniper, based here in sunny Auckland, and it's nice to see everybody in one place, all these familiar faces. When I started thinking about this talk, I thought, well, what can we as a vendor offer in terms of practical experience, and we've got a number of large deployments out there with some of our bigger customers, and I thought it would be quite good for myself just to go off and talk to a bunch of people that have already done this and figure out what was hard, what was easy, what they wish they'd done differently, that kind of stuff, and then bring that information back. So that's what I've tried to do with this presentation, and I've been to a few V6 conferences lately, and it seems like everybody needs to start out their presentations with about 5 or 6 minutes of talking about how we're running out of addressing. So I fully promise not to do any of that, and I promise not to have any of Jeff's slides on the actual depletion curve. It's coming. Oops, says that. So I thought this quote was kind of fitting for V6. I suspect Brian certainly didn't expect we'd be where we are when he started looking into this years ago, and I was certainly surprised at where we were when I started looking into it. And As Dean pointed out, the train wreck slide just had to go in there. I mean, the token slide on the current state of affairs, right? Things are messier than we would have liked. And I really want to know where this train came from, because that's really cool.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk a bit about the basics, about, you know, some of the design choices that our customers have made, what the real problems were, basic stuff like that, addressing, things like that. And then just kick into the OSS side of things and a bit on operations, because that is a very meaty topic in and of itself. And then I wanted to talk a bit about the transition approaches, not to go back over everything that Bill just went into, but to kind of talk at a high level about some of the practical differences for managing the different transition techniques. And then a very quick summary, and I'll be on my way. So to get into the basics, V6 is a very immature technology, or a mature immature technology, right? The standard work's done. We've known about it for a long time, but it's not really out there in a big way, so it hasn't been beaten up yet. So there's really no technical showstoppers that I'm aware of that would stop a carrier from deploying V6 today. And a lot of the hindrances or a lot of the obstacles are more up in the sort of the management plane or the soft plane, right? And that was broken down by one of the guys I talked to, is the 3 P's, right? So politics, people, and process. So politics, you gotta convince somebody that this is important, that vision's important, and that it's worth spending money on. Yeah, now, right? And what revenue? So it's a conversation that's actually probably getting more difficult rather than easier as the problem gets closer to us due to the financial stuff that's going on. So once organizations have been able to get over that hurdle, then there's the whole people problem, right? So managing people is very expensive, as I'm sure we all know, and training costs are huge, design efforts are huge, testing efforts are huge, and the more you add to something, obviously, the bigger all that gets. And then there's the fact that, you know, a lot of people are just kind of scared of V6, right? Seeing letters in there with dead beef in your routing table is a little unsettling to some. I know it certainly put me off for a long time. And then, like, the actual V6 team itself, I mean, it seems in most of the carriers that I talked to that nothing was going to happen without a few motivated guys just kind of getting it together and making lots of noise until something happened. And those guys tend to be the ones that wind up supporting everything, right? So you've got your senior guys supporting everything because nobody else really knows what's going on, and we all know how well that scales, right? So then we kick into the third part of the P's, and that's the process thing. So building the rest of the infrastructure to be able to support the services that are out there. And of course, to do that, that requires money, and you go back to stage one and go, wait, you want more? And where's the revenue? So I guess the reason I brought this up is more to kind of talk about, you know, V6 deployment as this continual process, right? Like, nobody I talked to said, right, yeah, we're done. And everybody sort of got to some stage along the way and kind of thought, well, customers are pushing traffic, good enough. I've got other fires to fight at the moment. So I think this is going to be a really long, ongoing discussion as to what, you know, transition actually means and how far we're actually able to take things. So sort of go from management plane down into more basics, right? In terms of addressing, it's not rocket science, right? We've sort of got this greenfields approach. You're deploying a new address family. You've got a chance to look at what went wrong with your, or what went right with your existing plan and sort of scale that going forward. So plan ahead, think about lots of growth, and keep it logical so it's easy to aggregate. That's just not rocket science, right? In terms of point-to-point link addressing, this is something that a lot of people have been discussing with various levels of passion in their voices. And I guess the original IEB recommendations, you know, said a subnet to 64, get on with it, don't ask any questions. And if two addresses are necessary and two are sufficient, I fail to see why more are required. And there is an RFC out there saying that /127s are harmful and shouldn't be used, but I think there's some consensus that they're not that bad. And I can actually point to some very, very large networks using this today. It does solve a few problems for us. I don't know how many people have looked into the ping pong issue, how you can essentially get two routers to DOS each other if they're having to send back ICMP messages. That's all avoided if we use 127. Carrying on with that, I guess, again, the original IEB recommendations were to, you know, to use anything that needed more than a subnet would get a /48. And that's all fine and good, but I don't need 65,000 subnets, right? And you know, if you've got a couple of different Bluetooth things hanging off here and you give this a 48, you've just wasted ridiculous number, right? So if you think about two people in a house with a /48, everybody's got one to a phone, that's like, what, 200,000 subnets for how many hosts? Really? So I think there's a document underway. Brian would probably know more, kind of revising those back. And, you know, a 56 seems to be a nice kind of compromise between enough subnets and not too many. Right. So, yeah, the 6NAT stuff, I sort of brought that up because that's quite a contentious topic, and sorry, I guess everyone can't see this at the bottom, but a lot of people are really religious that we don't need NAT with V6, and spending any time on it's pointless. It's going to be there, right? Get over it. And it's. I think we're all better off if we at least have a standard to point to, and we can point at implementations that don't do what we expect versus not having anything to point to. I mean, they might ignore us all the same, but at least we had a document to point to, right? I don't know. So, One thing I noticed with V6 is that there really aren't too many new discussions going on, right? We really haven't changed anything architecturally here. It's all the same old debates, but we've got a new chance to have it because there's a new technology coming along or a new window to look at things. So from an IGP perspective, this was about the best picture I could come up with to represent the difference between the two protocols. You got six of one and then half a dozen of the other. And it kind of depends which fruit you like. And that's more so now than it ever has been before. So ISIS is exactly the same as it has been since way, way back in time. Historically, it was the only IGP that you could use for both protocols, for V4 and V6. And we have actually seen some very, very large carriers make the migration from OSPF over to V6 for exactly that reason. But OSPF V3 is much, much more ISIS-like than V2 was, and that really stops a lot of us from being too religious and opinionated about the protocol anymore, because it really is very similar. So functionally, OSPF V3 essentially builds its graph or topology graph based on the 32-bit router ID that a V6 or the OSPF V3 router has. And that's kind of analogous to the CLNS world with ISIS, right? So you build your tree based on something other than the address family that you're carrying reachability information for. So the upshot of that is that when you get an LSA that updates a V6 prefix, you don't need to run an entire SDF. You can just do a partial route recalculation for the prefixes that were changed. So that's less CPU time and faster convergence at the end of the day. Also, I mean, one thing ISIS used to have was the advantage that if it got unknown TLVs that it didn't know what to do with, it would just flood them rather than choking, whereas OSPF, if it didn't get exactly what it wanted, it would freak out. So if you wanted to do a migration from, say, one feature set to another, you kind of had to do this big flag day upgrade of all the routers at once. So with all of these lessons learned and implemented into V3, there's functionally, well, practically speaking, very, very little in the way of difference between the two protocols. With Junos 9.2, you can now use OSPF V3 to carry both V4 and V6, and the only real difference between the two protocols then is the support for the traffic engineering attributes. If you're doing MPLS TE, So if you want to run OSPF and you're only doing IP, you can. If you only want to run ISIS, you can. It really becomes a do you need TE or not decision. And I mean, while I'm saying that some big guys are consolidating on ISIS, so they have a simple or a single protocol, is running two protocols really the end of the world? I mean, in a modern hardware-based platform with a reasonable CPU driving the control plane, IGPs shouldn't be a problem. But if they are, give us a call, because we like to have those conversations. And so at the end of the day, it's, you know, it is literally this, right? So pick one, find what works for you, and move on. And hopefully things will work well. I kind of felt obligated to have a slide on BGP here just because it's so important, but I don't have anything to say about it. This is more of a look and feel thing, right? So if you're already resetting next top self and it's working for you, keep it the same. If you're not, keep it the same. Whatever works. I mean, if you find something that's making your life difficult before, here's your chance to fix it. If not, keep it the same so that your operations staff have less to think about when they go from one to the other, right? In terms of sort of more ecosystem stuff, I don't know of a single implementation out there on any box that has complete feature parity between the two protocols. And I think that's a pretty natural state for things to be in given the state of deployment for v6 right now, right? So I think that's particularly acute for enterprise firewalls and probably some service provider firewalls as well, but definitely on the load balancing side of things. I've heard a number of content providers talking about the lack of load balancing support as being a big gating factor for them, which I think is kind of a rubbish argument because there really isn't enough v6 traffic out there to really require load balancing. But I understand their need to plan for scale, right? The sooner you guys let us know what's important to you first, the sooner we can prioritize things in the right direction. And security is always a good one, right? I mean, v6, again, the mature immaturity thing, right? It hasn't been beaten up in the wild for the past, 20-something years the way v4 has. So the rubber hasn't had to meet the road nearly as often, right? Things like rogue RA security just being standardized now, which means implementation shortly, and things like that. One of our, the guy who manages our cert response team made a vague hand-waving prediction a while back saying that there would be something like one security vulnerability a month based on compliance to the RFCs. And I don't think he's had to pay out yet, right? So we've still got a bit of a learning curve ahead of us, definitely on the security front. So to kick over into the operations and OSS side of things, I guess the real question becomes, what do you need to touch to turn v6 on? Stuart Bamford put together a fantastic presentation for Nanog back in 2005. It's definitely worth downloading, and I've plagiarized from it a few times here. And I look at this, and my first thought is, wow, is that all? Because that's kind of a lot of stuff. And then the question becomes, okay, well, I've got X amount of budget, and I need to have it turned on in, Y date. What needs to happen? Do I need DNS, IP addressing, monitoring, and billing? Is that enough for a stage one service? And then when am I going to get back to the rest of this stuff? Et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of worth kind of thinking these things out a little bit. And then there's the IT side of things, right? So how far can things go into the back of the organization, and are there upgrade timelines in any way synced up with the engineering side of the business? And then what about talking to our friends at the agencies, right? How far along is that stuff? And I tossed this in the next slide out more just to get people thinking. I don't know a tremendous amount about the OSS side of the world, but it seems that people who've been there before find that to be a massive chunk of the work. So I thought this one was interesting, right? So how many people actually have a script somewhere that does something like use a regular expression to find an IP address and then do something with it? Well, that's more than a few hands, right? So two reasons for bringing the slide up. Glenn Turner from RNET put this out recently saying essentially, it's an easy regular expression to find a 32-bit IPv4 address, but they couldn't find a way to do that with a regular expression in the v6 world. So what are you going to do then? I don't know. I'm not a scripting guy. I can barely spell script. So I brought this up for two reasons. One is just to, get people thinking about the assumptions that they might be making about v4. And secondly, I was expecting there to be more keyboards out there today, and I thought if I put up a slide saying that the Australians couldn't figure something out, I'd hear a big increase in volume on the keyboards as everyone else tried to have a go, but not enough keyboards to really make it a useful metric. So sort of back from the OSS world, more into operational stuff like filtering. I mean, again, it's kind of the same old discussions coming up again, right? It's just a new chance to revisit them. And there's a lot of consensus that we should be filtering better at this time because, it's hard to keep the internet a clean enough place. And there's also kind of a general feeling that maybe we're not quite as tight on the v6 side as we are on v4 yet, which is, I don't know. And I think there's a lot of people kind of hoping that, the whole cryptographic signing of advertisements and PKI stuff will solve this problem for us, so we don't have to keep mucking around with prefix lists. But I don't know. And again, so it's the same trade-off between, you know, rigor and operational overhead, and exactly the same discussions around deaggregation and multi-homing and traffic engineering. And fortunately, in terms of actual filters, like the CMYRU guys, who I believe are speaking tomorrow, have already come up with a great sort of filter set you can just plug into your routers. Kurt Doering also has a great site. And it kind of boils down to pretty simple stuff, like filter your customers to their specifics. That's really obvious, right? And then at a bare minimum, apply a Bogon sanity filter set and then accept anything up to a /48. Now, that's sort of a loose approach. The more strict approach is to do that and go through and match the prefix lengths to the registry allocations. But what I'm hearing is that this is a fair amount of work. And Gert's site here has a whole lot of detail on how much effort all that stuff is. So, again, I'm not going to try to go over in detail, well, in any detail at all, the stuff that Bill just talked about. I just wanted to give a really sort of high-level view of the transition approaches and what the practical implications for some of those would be. So the problem's pretty simple, right? We're out of addresses very shortly, and we can't just hand out private addresses on the WAN because there's a bunch of CTE out there that freak out if they have private addressing on both sides, potentially overlapping. And you could do that, but of course that means more phone calls and more costs and life's hard. And the third problem is that plenty of host implementations at the moment can't do native v6 only, like XP, right? XP can talk v6, but it won't resolve DNS queries over its v6 stack. So we can't skip dual stack, and we're out of addressing, and we can't use private addresses to sort of perform that stopgap function. So the workaround at the moment, I really hesitate to call it a solution, is essentially statmux, right? Statmuxing in the addressing space, which is a polite term for sharing global addresses, which is a horrible thing. And I kind of grouped the transmission mechanisms into two different flavors, if you will. And one is essentially translation, so it's either IVI or it's NAT444 or it's NAT64, whatever the flavor is. It's just translations, whether it's between addresses of the same type or different address families. And the second one is tunneling. So in the essentially the translation approach, you've got, you know, private address down here, you've got a global address up here, and that gets NATed to another global address up here. So you're sort of getting NATed a few times along the way. And so if you think about it, you've got these large-scale NAT boxes sitting in the middle of your network somewhere that are actually performing the translation function for you. And there's a lot of state involved in that, right? And these things aren't going to be cheap, and there's failover stuff to think about.